Oh, it's really lovely to be here. I especially think coming to somewhere that I thought I didn't know, and then I remembered that I recognised loads of you from our day that we had. Ooh, in May, thank you, in May, with the women. It was that we had a great time together. So yes, as Erica has said, I'm Ellie. I'm from Derby. And I unexpectedly fell in love with the Book of Ruth about this time last year, in fact. I decided that I'd got to a time in my life. Well, actually, what I decided was is that I was never going to have enough time in my life to do a master's, so now was as good a time as any. So I started doing a master's, and the first essays that I had to write for my master's, you had to pick a book from the Old Testament and you had to write three essays on it. And I was praying because I thought, I'm going to have to be reading the same book for the next, 6 months. I didn't want to pick Judges. I might get really depressed. But I wanted to pick something interesting. And I was praying about it and I felt like God kept saying, oh, do the Book of Ruth. And I was like, oh, I really don't want to do the Book of Ruth. And the reason was, I thought about it for a while, and the reason was that partly that, you always feel like as a woman you should talk on the Book of Ruth, and I'm not good with shoulds. And actually also because I became a Christian when I was 15, and when I was about 17, some very well-meaning youth worker who had possibly never read the Book of Ruth, I don't know, had suggested that I read it because it's good advice about relationships. And so I went and I read it. You're going to read this. It's not good advice about relationships. I just looked at it and I thought, yeah, no, I think I need to leave this. And I have, essentially, I did leave it. But then when I had to read it, when I gave in to what God was saying, what I discovered was it's not just a nice story. It's a book that is, well, firstly, it's really cleverly written. It's really, really beautifully put together as a book. And as a writer, there's something about that that I find really appealing because I think, wow, somebody didn't just write down this fairy story. This is a beautiful, beautifully written piece. And then what I realised is that it's a piece also that shows women being treated in a way which is... It's revolutionary in its context. If you've read the back end of the Book of Judges, you'll know that it's just a terrible, terrible list of violence against women. And then you get the Book of Ruth, where you have women who are able to make choices and are celebrated for making choices. And you get a book where it's a woman who shows what it is, what God is like, and that in the context of Judges is actually really just beautiful. So, and also I found it really challenging, and that's always a good place to make you fall in love with something if you have to wrestle with it a little bit. So, these chapters that I'm going to look at today last week you looked at the prologue, the beginning of chapter one. So I'm going to read through chapter one with you. And it's one of the things that's really interesting about this section to the end of chapter one is that it has this one word, shuv, in Hebrew, which means to return. That is repeated over and over again. And our translations often sort of disguise that because they sometimes say return and they sometimes say go back and they sometimes say turn. But actually, it's the same word. So the author writing this really wanted us to see this as a story of return. And that's a bit of a surprise because there are so many books in the Bible, or so many stories in the Bible, that start like Ruth starts. There is a man who's got two sons. And within the first how many verses it is, within the first five verses, the man and the two sons have been written out. And that's unexpected. Because we're used to it, aren't we? A man with two sons. We've seen Cain and Abel and Esau and Jacob and Isaac and Ishmael. Like, this is a story about a man and two sons. Oh, but it's not a story about a man and two sons. It's a story about a widow and two widows. So it's surprising. But here we have Shuv over and over. To return. It is good to return. The good that happens, the beauty that comes out of the ashes of this story happens because somebody decided to return to God. This word shuv is the same word that is used in Psalm 23, which is so familiar to us, when it says, he restores my soul. He returns my soul. He returns my soul back to where it should be. Although we live a life of constant returning. Like, I mean, you guys might be way holier down here in Rugby than we are up in Derby. But my experience of life, yeah, it's probably true. My experience of life is that it is a kind of constant slight drift and return. Slight drift and return. That returning is something returning to God is something I have to do every day. But Naomi is in this place where she has moved out of the promised land. She probably didn't have a lot of choice, let's face it, but she moved out of the promised land and she has been in Moab, and then something happens. There is a spark of hope in this story, and it's tiny. It's a tiny spark that changes everything. I don't know if you've ever tried to light a fire without matches. Anybody ever tried to light a fire with a tinder, a stone? We used to have somebody come and teach. I'm a guide leader. We used to have someone come and teach our guides every year to how to light a fire with a tinder. And you'd see them for ages trying to make a tiny spark. But if you got a tiny spark and you got something dry into it, you could start an entire bonfire from that tiny spark. And the whole bonfire that is the Book of Ruth and the story of redemption for Naomi starts with this spark just here. She had heard, while she was still in the country of Moab, that the Lord had had consideration for his people and given them food. She doesn't just decide one day to go home. No, she's heard something. That God has acted. And there are three ways that we see as like motifs all the way through the Old Testament and into the New of God acting and bringing life where there was no life. We see bread and babies and water. Life happening where there was no life. It's like God's signature move throughout the Old Testament to bring life in a place where life couldn't possibly happen. Right from the beginning of Genesis, where there is dry land and no water. So how could you possibly have a garden? And God separates waters and he brings up a spring onto that dry land. And this is what's happened here. In a time of famine, in a place where there's no life, God has acted and brought life out of his own goodness, his own generous goodness. And it's that that sparks everything that happens in this story. And you're going to see some water, and you're going to see some babies. You're going to see God acting behind the scenes and making life where there is no life. Because that's what he does. And so Naomi decides to go home, and I read this quote, home is this place where when you have to go there, they have to take you in. And I think that is, it's a quote from an American poet called Robert Frost. I think it says something about the attitude of Naomi at this point. Like, she is not rejoicing at going home. She's not thinking, oh, Oh, it's so good to go home. She's thinking, I have nothing else left and nowhere else to go. So I'm going to have to go home because I know that when I get there, they'll have to take me in. And as it happens, they don't. But anyway, well, not immediately anyway. But she realizes there's nothing else, there's no future for her where she is, so she decides to go. And we don't hear very much about the journey, we just hear about this point that happens. This is a screenshot, by the way, this is from my day job. I work as a writer for a, I write emails, basically, for a an amazing media mission in Pakistan, which is declaring the love of God to the people of Pakistan through TV and social media. This is from a show called Women of the Bible. And here they are. This is Naomi and Ruth and Orpah on the road. And these, I think that Naomi must have been a pretty extraordinary person, mustn't she? That these girls want to go with her. I think she must have been a wonderful, wonderful woman. We see her at her worst. In this, we see her at her lowest moment. But I think there must have been something about her that these women want to go with her. And she says to them, turn back, my daughters. Why would you go with me? Go back so that the Lord can give you security in a house of your husband. And she kissed them and they wept aloud. And they said to her, no, we will go with you to your people. But Naomi says, turn back, my daughters. Why would you go with me? Do I still have sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. And even if I thought there was hope for me, even if I did get a husband, then tonight and bear sons. Were you going to wait until they're grown up? And Naomi's referring to a law that was there, which was to provide for widows, to make sure that widows were able to stay in the family. They would marry the next son down. But Naomi hasn't got a next son down. And she's being realistic about her hope of having a next son down at this stage. Because she is old for the time. I'm going to say for the time, because I kind of worked it out that she can't really possibly be older than about 45. So we're going to say old for the time, if that's okay with you. Because her daughters have been married, her sons have been married for 10 years. Sons probably got married around about 20. The girls are probably a bit younger than that when they get married. So these girls are probably 25. And Naomi is probably 40, 45 at the oldest. But there's no hope for them and no future for them with her. Her family has dissolved. There's no security that she can provide for them. And actually, Naomi is going home where they have to take her in, but these girls aren't going home if they go with her. And I think this is interesting. If you ever see Moab written in the Bible, it should be written like this. You know, Moab is a dive as far as the Bible is concerned. It really is. If you look back through, Moab is... Remember when Abraham and Lot just decide that they can't be together, they can't cope, they have to go their separate ways? Well, Lot goes off and goes his separate ways. And then one of his daughters tricks him into sleeping with her. And then there's a child, and that child is Moab. So Moab is the child of incest and the child of separation and from the people of God and the child of argument. So that's not good. Like, you know, that is a red flag. Yeah. So Ruth and Orpah are carrying this red flag. A little while later, when the people of Israel were drifting past Moab, a whole load of Israel soldiers were compromised by the women of Moab. I think there might have been some compromising on both sides, but that's not quite how it's told in here. These if you're from Moab, you've got the reputation of being a woman of ill repute just from being from there. I feel I have a little understanding of this. I don't know, anybody here old enough to have listened to Steve Wright in the afternoon? Yeah. So I want to tell you that in the year before I went away to university, he started his whole thing about Essex girls, and I am from Essex. And I went away to university. I had to queue up to pick up my grant check. That's a thing of the past. I had to pick up my grant check under a sign saying Essex. And I can tell you that the boys from Devon and Cornwall made all sorts of comments. Because Essex girls had a reputation. And they had a reputation that involved dancing around handbags and wearing white stilettos, but also for being easy, shall we say. So the girls from Moab carry that reputation times about 40. You know, they have the red flag. And so they are going to go. They're proposing to go with Naomi into this place where they will be regarded as trash. And actually, they won't have any family there. They won't have the protection of family. They won't have any money because they are women and that's how it works. And they have no husbands and no sons, which means they have no identity. And they are hated foreigners. So let's face it, Orpah made the sensible choice. She went back to a place where there was a possibility of life for her. And Ruth, essentially, when she chooses to go with Naomi, is choosing death. She's choosing no future. Because there's no way, if you've just read this bit and you haven't read the rest, there's no way that she is going to get a husband. No man is going to marry somebody from Moab. And she's not young. And it never tells us that she's beautiful, despite all of the illustrations that you've seen. It tells us that she's capable of carrying something like 30 kilos worth of barley on her back, which suggests to me that she's, you know, she's got something about her. She's definitely not sort of like, you know, I don't know what I threw at you. I apologise, I'll pick it up later. She's definitely not sort of drifting beautifully and gracefully through the fields at this stage. And also she's not had a child. And she's been married for 10 years. So she is also childless. And people would have considered that as a curse. They would have considered that she was cursed. And so when she makes this choice and she says, I was going to read it off that screen, but I can't read it off that screen. It's too far away. Oh, marvellous. Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where will I go? Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. This is massive. It's a commitment bigger than marriage. Because look, where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Like, in our marriage ceremony, we say, until death separates us. But Ruth goes one bit more than that. There's some interesting stuff in here. I read somebody wrote that this is actually a bit more radical than Abraham. In all the history, in all the story, the only other time that you see somebody being prepared to leave their people and go to another people in this way is Abraham. And he had a word from God about it. And Ruth just chooses. She just chooses to go for it. It also sounds very much like a lot of royal covenants that are made in the Old Testament. This way, your people will be my people, your God will be my God. It sounds kind of royal. Now that is a little hint, a little tiny hint as to what's going to happen later. But right now, this is a picture of God's love for us. Ruth's loving choice towards Naomi is a picture of God's love towards his people. I think it's amazing that God chooses a destitute, childless, foreign woman to demonstrate to the world what his love is like. I said, isn't that just so what our God is like? So he's like, ah. Oh. And she, I think I've got a slide about this. Yeah, she shows a love which is committed and determined and massively risky. Like, what is in this for Ruth? What is it? Nothing. There is nothing in this decision for Ruth. Like, she doesn't have a future if she just chooses this, but this is what she chooses. What does she get? What is she expecting back in return from Naomi? Nothing. Naomi's got nothing to give her in return. It is fierce and it is active. It is love with boots on. It is not a love which is just a feeling. It is a love which is going to do something. It's a love which is going to go and toil in the fields every day for 6 weeks. It is extraordinary. And this, and, you know, we only have one word. And you'll see, actually, if you read words that translate, this word that is used here to describe God and which people will come to use to describe Ruth, which is hesed. It's the love that God has for his people. And you'll see that translators struggle with it. And sometimes they call it steadfast love, and sometimes they call it loving kindness. And sometimes they call it covenant love. And it's because it's all of those things. And we just don't have enough of a power-packed word. I'm still throwing things. Earrings, I think. We don't have a powerful enough word to say everything that is in what God's love for us is like. So we have to try and remember all of this stuff when it says that God loves us, that God loves his people, that it is a love that is committed, it's a love that will keep going even if we are rubbish in return. It is a love that he has covenanted with us and which is not able to be rescinded. It is extraordinary. Do you know, I love Paul's prayer for the church in Ephesus. He says, I pray that you will have the ability to know Christ's love that surpasses knowledge. Like, I pray that you will be able to know this thing, which is not impossible at all for you to know. It's not possible at all for you to know it. But I'm praying that you'll know it. like, okay, thanks, Paul. That's really helpful. But I think what he's trying to get at is just that however much of God's love we know, there is more for us to know. So, like, here's an experiment. Who in this room has been a Christian for more than 10 years? Okay, well, that's a lot. 20? 30? 40? Anyone want to admit to 50? Oh, there we go, 50. Anyone more? 60? We want 60. Okay, 60. You guys who've had your hands up then, do you know that however much of God's love you have experienced in that 60 years, it's a tiny amount of what there is. There is so much more of God's love for you to experience. There is so much more that he has for you because his storehouses are infinite. So however much of God's love you have experienced so far, you're not going to plateau. It's like this. So this is a picture of the earth over the Pacific Ocean. And that boat is the boat that's on the cover of a book from my childhood called Swallows and Amazons about about some children who set off on an adventure to explore the sea, the lake that there is. And it feels to them like there is an infinite amount to explore. And yet what God says to us is that you can't measure the height or breadth or depth or width of the love of God. It is like us sitting in a swallow's and Amazon's boat on the edge of the Pacific Ocean, which from this angle takes up more than half of the world. And there is so much to explore. So if you feel like you've plateaued, then you need to come and get someone to pray for you, because there's so much more to explore. And there always, always will be. So, let's keep going with the story, because we do want to go home at some point today. So something extraordinary happens here. Ruth chooses to go with Naomi. Ruth chooses to belong. She has no qualification to belong. She's from Moab. She's got no qualification to belong, but she chooses to belong. I find that massively challenging for all the times that I have felt, or that I have spoken to people who feel like they don't quite belong in God's people. Oh, I just don't feel like I belong here. It's like, well, choose to belong. You belong. Yeah? Like, actually, from this point onwards, Ruth can't choose not to belong. She belongs because she chose to. Not because she was qualified. Not because of Naomi's reaction. Naomi says nothing at this point. Ruth makes this extraordinary commitment to her that is more extraordinary than anything that has been seen in the Bible so far, except for what God has done. And Naomi says nothing. In fact, this is them on the edge of Bethlehem, and I wonder what is going through Ruth's heart at this moment as they see Bethlehem in the distance. It's been quite a walk. It's taken them a while to get there. But we know what's going on in Naomi's heart, because when they finally get there, she says this. The two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem, and when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred up because of them. And they said, "Is this Naomi?" They haven't seen her for a while. She's done her hair differently, I don't know. "Is this Naomi?" And she said to them, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. For the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi?" Naomi means pleasant. "Why call me Naomi when the Lord has dealt harshly with me and the Almighty has brought calamity on me?" Mara means bitter. It's the same word. It's the same word that's used for that stream that Moses and the people of God encounter when they come across, when they've crossed they've crossed the Red Sea, and they come to a stream and it's bitter. It's a stream called Mara. It's undrinkable. And we know what happens in that story. Moses throws a stick in it and it becomes sweet. But Mara is bitter. Naomi has become bitter. And her bitterness has made her blind to the goodness that God has given her in Ruth. She says, "I've come back empty." She's had this woman who, Ruth has chosen friendship with Naomi. She has chosen a commitment to a woman in a society where all security, where all sense of identity, where all sense of value, it comes from the men you're associated with. And in that context, Ruth has chosen a woman. But Naomi is absolutely blind to that at this point, because she is so caught up in her bitterness. And sometimes we do get to this place where we define ourselves by our experiences. Like, I am the sum of everything that I've thought and everything that I've done. And like, worse than that, of everything that people have done to me and everything that has happened. Like, that is who I am. I want you to notice that the narrator never calls her Mara. She calls herself that, but the narrator says, just keeps calling her Naomi. Very next line, so Naomi returns, together with Ruth. Ruth, who returns to a place that she didn't come from, and yet somehow she's still returning. Because it's possible to return to God if you're bitter. It's possible to return to God with a terrible attitude. It is possible to return to God when you have never been with God before, and it's always good to return to God. Even with a terrible attitude, it is great that Naomi came back, because it is always good to return. It is always the time to return. I read this scene yesterday, and it reminded me of a movie that my older children loved, and so I have watched probably 20 billion times in short pieces. You know, like, I don't know what the current Disney film is, but like, if you've got children who've got a fixation on one particular film, bless you. Like, I know that feeling. But this was The Lion King, and this is, you know, like the great Disney story of a return. But before Simba has like run away, and he's been in a forest where, instead of being a proper lion, he's being nuts and berries and being friends with other animals and all kinds of things. He's not being himself. And he realizes that he should return, that he needs to return. And yet he's scared to return because he's not who he should be. He's not the person that he was when he left. He's been living a different kind of life, and he doesn't want to return. And he has this encounter with his father, who is dead, so forgive me for that. It's just a Disney film. It's just a metaphor. He has his encounter with his father, who is dead, and what his father says to him is, you're not who you've become. Like, you know, actually, your identity is not in who you're being right now. That's not where your identity lives. He says, remember who you are, and who we are is children of God. And our home is with God. Your home is the place when you are standing right in the middle of the blessing of God. You are my child. That's my home. My home is in the middle of a ring on the floor where it says, you are my child, in you I'm well pleased. And I step out of that all the time. But that is my home. And that is where I'm supposed to return to. You are my child, in you I'm well pleased. And so, I have wandered, slightly randomly through this passage, where it's taken us. But these are the three things that I would like to leave you with. Love is, do you remember the Cartoons? They never said this. Love is risky. Love is committed. Love is all in. That is God's love for us, and the love that he asks us to show to each other and to the world. It's all these things. Like, if you don't feel challenged by that, then you're not awake. If you're not awake, I'm really sorry. Number two, you can be like Ruth. Be like Ruth. Choose to belong. Don't sit around on the edge waiting for other people to feel like you belong, make you feel like you belong. You know, you do belong because you chose to be here. That's how you get to belong in God's people. Choice. And remember who you are. You are a child of God, and he is pleased with you. Not because of what you've done, but because he created you and you are his child, and that makes him pleased with you. Which is just extraordinary. I wish I could adventure with you on into the book of Ruth, because it is beautiful and you are going to have a wonderful time in it. But I'm just going to pray now for you that right at the beginning of the book of Ruth, even if like Naomi you are holding ashes, even if like Ruth you are facing a future that is not as certain as you would like it to be, even if, like Ruth and Orpah, you feel like you are carrying the marks of not belonging, that it is time to return. Lord Jesus, thank you that your love for us, that your love for the world surpasses knowledge. Thank you that even if we have been adventuring in the ocean of your love for 50, 60 years, we are still only at the beginning. And Lord, I pray that you will help us to know that we belong and to remember who we are in you. Amen.